Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 45, where we are continuing to discuss Fred Alford's Whistleblowers, Broken Lives, and Organizational Power. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
So in the previous part, we have been thinking about the issue of whistleblowing, and following the path of Alford, we took a more, I would say, individual-based approach. And we hinted also at the issue of the way Alford talks about organization, which sometimes can be absolutist, you know, as Mariana was saying. But as someone interested in organizational theory and specifically organizational structures like bureaucracy, I actually had, you know, some kind of counterpoints to some of the things that Alford was bringing up. And we touched upon that before as well. Ralph and Tom talked about the honors code in the military. Mariana was talking about these the occupational values involved in being a doctor. So that's what I feel that's somehow, you know, half-baked, at least in the book, because a lot of the action of the whistleblowers, I imagine, can come at least from one occupational value, that is what is perceived in that specific kind of work as to be correct or wrong. There was also interesting discussion by Paul Duguay on the idea of ethics of the office, of how bureaucrats and people that fulfill a specific office actually are able to take ethical decisions because they understand and live through that office they occupy almost as a life form. So it's not only a formal place in the hierarchy, but also a way of seeing the positions. So I think that a lot of the actions of the whistleblowing, because I'm reading from more organizational lenses, can come from the very nature of the work, the very nature of socialization that they have, the very nature of the way the organization is structured, which is something that Alford always isn't necessarily negative. You know, there is this implicit idea that the formal organization is something that gets on the way of the person, and not necessarily something that equips the person to make differentiations what counts as ethical or not.
In a similar vein, there's almost I took a very interesting look at the part in which Alford described the sphere of the organization from the perspective of the whistleblower, which was essentially focused on the boss and those who were the whistleblower is immediately affected by. And that, so in your perspective, you know, when you're looking at the totality of the organization and how the organization functions and responds to conditions in the environment, and how different that is from the perspective of an individual who's looking at basically just those parts of the organization in which there's immediate transaction with. And one of the things that I just kind of struck to my mind as I think about myself every time I join a new organization, my aperture is wide. You know, I come in, I am treated as a new member of the group. And then over time, one of two things happens. Either my aperture stays wide, which is usually sort of like a feeling in which I am committed to the organization and my commitment is being sustained, or my aperture starts to narrow, which is based on perhaps, oversimplifying this greatly, the accumulation of negative transactions. So I can understand why, say...
Can I ask you, explain a little bit more what you mean when you say your aperture is wide and narrow? Can you explain a little bit more before you...
Yeah,
I think it's interesting.
Let's say that when I joined the Army... Initially, that's what I was joining. I was thinking more of being part of the Army as opposed to just my particular unit or just my particular situation. The first time in which I experienced this was perhaps a situation where I could have been a whistleblower but didn't. Was the first time in which I experienced how I stopped thinking about myself as committed to the entire Army as the big organization, and my focus just narrowed to that I was only concerned about what my boss and my boss's boss, or you know, those in which I was immediately transacting with, and then you know it was almost like the only way in which I could reverse that was to wait until I had a chance to change the situation where I joined another unit. I moved to a new duty station. I was no longer associated with that particular unit, and I can see how. Like in the case of the whistleblower may have joined the Department of Energy or may have joined a large organization feeling a sense of commitment to the organization writ large, and that everybody is a member of the organization is my friend, if you can think of it that way. But then in the negative experience of being singled out after the act of whistleblowing, then everything really seems to narrow down to who is going to come and hurt me. And that's where I can kind of see why from the whistleblower's perspective, it can become really all about who's my boss and what is my boss going to do to me, or who are these other actors that I am working with, and what are they going to do to me? And I see the same sort of phenomenon happen in other forms of individual trauma within an organization. If you are the victim of something, then your aperture of who you're concentrating with within the organization narrows down to those around you who you think could be out to get you in some fashion. And so kind of like when I was thinking about, you know, Alfred's talking about whistleblowers in organizations who are basically operating on their worst impulses, are there other categories of people within the organization whose experiences are similar, perhaps not to the same effects? And I can think of cases of victims of harassment, and this is an odd case perhaps, but like entrepreneurs or change agents who they're not whistleblowing per se necessarily, but if they seem to step out of line and they draw attention to themselves using the same sort of moralistic narcissism, does the organization's reactions to them in terms of active resistance or ostracizing, is there a similarity, and does that mean something for, say, how organizations just overall deal with deviance from the norm?
Yeah, I think you raise a great point, Tom, because I think for whether you want to call it entrepreneurism in general or internal change agents, I think there's a lot of similarities with whistleblowing in that they're both are shaking things up. You know what I would say in the internal change agent point of view, they're trying to change things up, shake things up, but they think there's something deficient, but it may not be illegal or unethical. But in the final analysis, they're both trying to change things, the whistleblower or this change agent. So I think that's a great point. I see many overlaps with it. I mean, I think the moralistic aspect may be lacking, or maybe different. It's probably not lacking, just different. One thing I want to just spring from your question about or your comment about how the organizations change or protect themselves and stuff. So one of the things that bothered me about the way Alfred presents this is that he anthropomorphizes organization like it's a thing, or it can be an actor, and so that bothered me because I don't think of organizations that way. I think of them as collection of individuals, and sure, you can have some collective action, but I don't think that the organization thinks. I think it works more on a micro level, and then you can look at it as, okay, the organization is doing this, but I think it's on this micro level. It goes back to what Mariana was saying earlier, where these people are seeking to protect themselves from this person that's speaking up or pointing out that there's these differences or that they're harming people. That's how I see it, is this behavior that really starts at a very individual level. But I thought your point was really a good one, Tom.
I didn't really see it as problematic, though, because I read it as it's not that organizations have agency and they do things. It's more that the retaliation that is unleashed upon the whistleblowers is more done in the name of and for the sake of the organization. And that's what makes it kind of even more sinister, that it is done for the purposes of maintaining basically an imaginary abstract concept that the whistleblower can't communicate with, right? So the extensive descriptions of how whistleblowers are isolated, neglected, ignored, shut out, all that kind of stuff, that's not because the empirical examples are that people refuse to talk, but it's not the interpersonal failure as much as it is or agents of organization acting in this way on behalf of the organization. And we know, of course, that organizations are not a thing and they're not a living organism, and that they're either productions or reductions of individuals. But I think that's one of the core almost like paradoxes here, that whistleblowers are blowing a whistle on something that is an agreed upon state of affairs, and then they are being shut out of that state of affairs without the ability to appeal almost.
Okay, and I think that was that's a good way to see it. I think as maybe possibly taking a more maybe not extreme, but a farther side of the spectrum. I like the way you said it's more like acting on behalf of the organization, because I think we do agree it's people acting, and it's maybe this one can debate at what level of consciousness this protection of the organization occurs, and it probably varies by individual. I think that's a good way to see it, though, and I feel a little bit better, so I'm not maybe disagreeing quite so much with Alfred. Is
the way he put it, it's almost as if it's the immune system response, kind of the way I saw it. And he talks about whistleblowers being treated more as patients and subjects rather than colleagues and individuals.
Yeah. And so the other thing I think is interesting, though, I don't know if we talked about it as much as I would like to, so I'll just make briefly stated. And Mariana made a statement about this in the earlier parts. Is that this? It's not just that the whistleblower is this contagion and has to be resisted and fought with antibodies. Their existence has to be wiped out. And Alfred talks about that several times, right? And so that's one of the reasons one would think is one of the motivations behind removing them from the system, like you were talking about, Dimitri, just kind of in the way that the immune system would. And Alfred talked about many cases, and I'm sure Mariana could give us examples of the whistleblowers moved to closets, or bathrooms, or some of these places where nobody's near them. So there's this level of ostracization, that occurs to wipe them out. And then the other aspect of denying existence is this aspect of nobody talks about it, right? It becomes what Argyris calls an undiscussable undiscussable, right? The fact that it's not discussable, you can't even talk about it, right?
Well, so that's another thing that I saw. Let's explore that one a little bit more too, because now here it is, we're in the late 2010s, and we are entering an era in which information is ubiquitous. Information is absolutely everywhere. You have security cameras that are appearing all over the place. We've got drones in the sky. We've got all of, what I'm kind of getting at here is we're now entering in, to back up, whistleblowing, the behavior of whistleblowing and retaliation is fostered by the ability for secrecy, if you will. So in an environment in which information is being more available and the ability for, say, a whistleblower or somebody who is speaking up to gather adherents in a hurry, and just to use a contemporary example, the Me Too movement, how do we think that might change the dynamic as to what happens with whistleblowers? Because now it's going to be a little bit, one would think maybe it might be easier for them to be able to plead their case in a way that the organization can't just, you know, hide, circle the wagons, shoot off the scapegoat. I don't know. What do you all think might happen?
So let me give you just a brief comment about that, because I agree with you. We are in sort of the age of surveillance. And I think the first thing they do when they're doing some sort of external investigation prompted by a whistleblower or not, but often it is, first place they go is the emails and text messages that people sent, right? And there's some famous stuff. And that's some of what Snowden was making widely public. So these things that conversations people thought were private, you know, weren't anymore. And it's amazing, you know, the kind of things that get brought up. So here's what I was thinking about that. I tend to agree with you that we are in this age of surveillance, and I think it's changing the dynamics some. But I also wonder if it's in some ways it doesn't change anything, because a lot of it comes down to, you know, you could read the FBI report or the reports about what Snowden did, but the FBI report on the Clinton email server, this and that investigation, and you could pretty much take that any way you want.
There is an inescapable degree of uniformization, if I can put it so, uniformity, which really obliterates individuality. That's in the nature of bureaucracy, and that's in the nature of organized, large organized, entities. Now, so of course, those entities in order to increase their legitimacy and their raison d'etre, their purpose, so to speak, as Pedro mentioned, they have this ethical systems and values that people do believe in. And still, by and large, people do believe in those values because they choose that profession over others that could give them, I don't know, quicker promotion or more money or whatever. Now, so I think this demonstrates very well the inevitable trade-offs between actually, you know, being in a group and retaining one's own individuality, right? And starting from the smallest groups, we really are, we are social animals. I think I said we do exist in relation to others. For me, that's a fundamental thing. And we exist in the symbolic, you know, system of norms, laws and values and so on, which is of course not immutable, obviously. We are all the time from very, very early on pulled towards the others and repelled at the same time because of the sacrifices this implies for our individuality. There is a very interesting discussion that Alford has on law. And he actually says that how law fails individuals because it follows the procedures. But at the same time, he recognizes that procedurality that's inherent and intrinsic to the law, you know, it's at the heart of, you know, the democratic theory of governance, right? We want a law to be predictable, impartial, fair. And so we have to have some inviolable procedures. At the same time, he bemoans that fails, you know, the understanding of what it is and what whistleblowers try to do for society. And this is all fair. This is exactly how he puts it. Nevertheless, there is a real, real tension here. And that tension, I would say, is more, pronounced in specific systems than others. And I'm moving to your second part of your contribution of this very interesting conversation that you had. It's no coincidence that Alford, you know, really refers quite a lot to Bauman. I'm not saying that Bauman's work is very important, but Bauman's experience is very specific as well. And he really focuses our attention in a very useful way. I like Bauman, by the way. But actually, this is a really specific experience, as is the experience of large organizations, right? And moving now to early 2000, the early 2000. I think the nature of organizing has changed quite a lot. I mean, big monolithic organizations are by no means the only organizations we have, right? So I do really think that we have a diverse organizations, and all these phenomena, you know, like the quest for organization to inevitably, I would say, obliterate the individuality, maybe a bit less relevant, I would say, in small organizations, in one-person organization, in networked organizations, and we can go on and on and on, I would say. That would be one. Secondly, something very, very important that I also wanted to mention is that with the increasing transparency, I think the role of whistleblowers, I think in a way it's rehabilitated. Maybe we won't call them anymore. I don't know. Of course, we will always need whistleblowers. We will always need people who are prepared, to use Alford's terminology, to sacrifice themselves for the greater good, although they may not consciously really do that fully consciously. Because if you ask whistleblowers from our research, they would say, we didn't expect, you know, that the retaliation will be so vicious. I thought I was doing my job. I was just wanting, I thought I will be thanked for my service, and so on and so forth. So, and people say, even in our research at least, well, we would have done it, but probably differently. And that's quite important. That differently is quite important. What can we as organizations do in order actually to retain that positive, if you see what I mean, that outsiderness, that kind of willingness of whistleblowers to actually not to double down, no, and that willingness to actually see, imagine fully the consequences of one's action. These are very important. We know, I'm sure Pedro will agree with me, that, you know, that one of the failures of bureaucracy is just, you know, this unwavering following of the procedures to the, I mean, the formal versus substantive rationality, right? A very well-known debate already from the Weber's time, right? So we need to retain that kind of clear view that whistleblowers provide. At the same time, we don't, as society, moving to implications, I think there is a shift in that direction, probably not as quick, not as extensive as it should be, and so on. That's why we need to work towards that. But actually, there is a shift of actually, you know, removing this kind of heroic, romanticized view from a whistleblower, and then just actually consider, you know, the activity of raising concerns and normalizing this heroic act, so to speak, making it a much more mundane and therefore recognized. And I think it's quite important. And my final point, and I'm finishing, is what you've mentioned. We are agents of transparency. I think it's crucial, you know, and we see whistleblowers as somebody who is closer to us as well, rather than, okay, Ed Snowden is still a heroic individual. But actually, you know, he was like, you know, a relatively middle-level, you know, agent in Hawaii, stationed in Hawaii, you know. I mean, he's not somebody who has, okay, he had a privileged access, but not the highest security clearance. I mean, I read his story from a variety of sources. I'm not trying to undermine what he did. He was very well organized, and crucially, he learned from the experience of previous whistleblowers. So that learning point is also quite important. How we as society, you know, kind of use that power that the information on our fingertips gives us, you know, and of course the danger that when everything is all in the open and transparent, everything is meaningless, because you can take it in any direction. I think that those are the, in my view, the challenges that your generation more than mine will have to actually face and reconfigure.
Yes, I wholly agree that we want to normalize the kind of conversations that help us, you know, help us do the right thing. And I guess the concern or the question I have going in my mind on that is that where does that process of normalization really begin? How do you actually instill that? And it would seem like that's not the sort of a thing that you can instill in, you know, by the time somebody starts joining the workforce, that's kind of too late, is it not? How do you actually instill those conversations or prepare people to be able to go into those conversations and feel like it's normal, as opposed to, say, like right now at entry-level education, we try to instill values, and then the first thing that happens when you go into the door is that, you recognize that this is not going to be the same sort of a...
It was all rubbish. So let me, I'm going to respond to your question. I know Peter's got some comments, but I'm going to put a kind of a personal spin on this because we are in the implications of practice section. So I don't have special insight on how to do this for everybody, but in Navy Nuclear Power, we actually work very hard at socializing that an acceptance of speaking up. And we actually have a name for it and we train on it regularly. And it's called watch team backup. So for someone's on your watch team is a group of people, sort of like could be an airplane cockpit or the crew of a airplane when you include the flight attendants and others. And so if you're a member of that team, we actually repeat many, many times in training. It's regularly repeated that you have an obligation to speak up, like Mariana was talking about earlier. And we don't punish people for not speaking up, but we try to publicize as much as possible opportunities people took to speak up. And one of the things I was thinking, Tom was talking about this, it may even be too late by the time people come into the workforce. One of the things I thought about that when I was the reactor officer in charge of two nuclear reactors on an aircraft carrier, I thought about that. And I thought that could be a problem. So I worked at teaching the officers to go beyond this idea of, oh, yes, you should value feedback. You should value the person that speaks up and who gives you watch team backup. And I went to them and I said, you have to do two things. One is when you get watch team backup, if you respond negatively or sharply or curtly and cut that person off, that's the last time you're going to get watch team backup from them. And you may suffer in the future because they may see something that you don't. So I stressed to them the role they had in encouraging and nurturing that kind of speaking up. And then the second thing I would tell them was you actually have to give them opportunities to speak up. And so it's not the same. And in a military context, this is not simple, but it's not the same as saying, well, I don't know what I'm doing. People should tell me, but it's more along the lines of, you give a briefing and then ask if people have questions. And one of the hallmarks of a briefing like this in Navy Nuclear Power is it is not acceptable to finish the briefing and have no questions. So, people must are expected to speak up. And so we work a little bit about that. I can't really order someone to speak up, but we try to indicate that in fact, if people don't speak up, it means they don't understand what's going on well enough. And therefore, we need to take a pause or do something else before we proceed. And we tell stories about things like that for people to understand.
And they have to be, because one of the things I think happens sometimes is that there's an assumption that as you go up, your ability to handle the responsibility and to keep the conversation moving just naturally grows with it. But I think, just trying to keep that psychological space open at higher levels or for those who are more advanced to try to get over whatever bad episodes that they have had earlier in their careers is also somewhat important. Otherwise, what, junior folks who perhaps are coming in with these expectations of being able to open and to bring, speak truth to power are looking at those above them who are, silent, wounded, and not conversing as openly. And they're going to follow suit.
That's a great example. And in fact, the thing I used to say to people, I know you had the same experience, I used to say to people, nobody see when I became a senior officer in the military, but it could be the same thing in a regular organization where you become a senior manager. What I used to say was, nobody sees me as me, at least if they haven't known me for a while. They see me as the embodiment of every manager or senior officer they've ever known, and particularly these people like you were talking about, Tom, that 10 years ago they cut somebody off or basically berated somebody in public for bringing something up, and so I felt like that was something I had to work at to develop an expectation of the people that work with me that, oh, yeah, he is going to listen to me. And he's not just like every captain. In fact, periodically people would say, you're not like these other people that that I've known or met in my career, which I thought that's a good sign, right? That not only was I maybe operating differently, but that they felt free enough to say that out loud to me.
You know, for those who might be sitting in the manager's seat and you have a whistleblower, you know, somebody who's going to come to you, how do you react? Are you aware of your, are you aware of the reaction?
Right. So let me give you a personal example about that. Yeah. Cause I think that's a great question. So I'll give this another personal example. So, and this, I think this connects to several things. Mariana said, I'll be very interested in her comments, but everybody's comments, and I can make, I'll keep it short. And so I was in a position in the Navy as a senior officer, where it was my organization's job to audit the progress and performance of a shipyard, a commercial shipyard or private shipyard, building a ship. And the people that work with me told me many times they're behind. They're not where they say they are. But we lacked a lot of good analytical tools to be able to show that for reasons I won't go into. And so we were searching for what was, and then whenever we would say this to the people in Washington, D.C. who are in charge of the money and many other aspects of this, we were told, well, the shipbuilder says they're on time. The shipbuilder says you're wrong. And pretty much that would be the end of the conversation. And I would say, well, yeah, but here's all these qualitative tools that we use that say they're behind by every single measure of those. And they haven't got a single one they can point to. Well, I basically just got told to shut up several times. And then we reached a point where we actually finally had some analytical tools. It was essentially testing of systems. You know, you could show a testing progress rate of the systems. And I was able to show with numbers that based on where we were with the tests, we couldn't finish by the time that everybody was planning to be finished and what the shipyard said. We would be done. And the people that were working with me said, well, we estimate they're about 6 weeks to 2 months behind based on these numbers that we have that were pretty solid. And so do you think I was thanked when I tell the people in Washington, D.C., look, here's the numbers I have now. The course, you know, nobody said to me, oh, you've been telling us for the last year. And thank you for telling us. Nobody thanked me. And in fact, one of I was a peer of mine in Washington, D.C. I reported to. He was still didn't agree with me. And I said, look, here's the way this works. One of us is going to call your boss, who's the admiral. You know, so we're talking now one step away from who I'm supposed to report to. I said, one of us is going to call the boss. So it's either going to be you conveying what I told you, or it's going to be me. You get that choice, but you don't get the choice about calling your boss. Because he must know this. And so as we went further forward on that, I got all this, what I would call hate and discontent or storm and drang or, you know, just strong negative reaction came up upon me. But basically, once I could show with the numbers, people were just venting their frustration on me as opposed to saying, well, you're wrong, because I had good numbers at that point. And to finish up the story, and I had several interactions with very senior officers in the Navy. No one ever came back to me and said, gee, you were right, and we made it too hard on you, and we're thankful that you spared us this huge public embarrassment of, you know, saying that the ship would be ready and making all these plans, inviting all sorts of officials and having the ship not be ready. Not a single person ever came to thank me. And so when I read that comment in the book about the person who said, well, how could I look at myself in the mirror? You know, I actually thought those kinds of things. And so the last part I want to say about this is I don't know if I was doing it for narcissistically more, you know, moralist reasons, but my view was, the view I took was, okay, if I could get fired either way. I could get fired if I go along with the shipper and say it's ready and it's not ready. You know, people are going to, because it was my responsibility to say this. So as we were talking, it was my job to make this call. I could get fired for not doing that well, or I could get fired because people weren't happy about the news I was telling them. So either way, I was going to get fired. So I did feel like one of these dead, you know, become as one already dead. But I thought, well, at least if I got fired for saying what I thought was the right thing, and upholding the standard of what I thought my job was supposed to be as an internal auditor.
Whistleblowers do a very important service for us. They suffer for their courage, and that actually we as society have a role to play, not only in protecting them, but actually not believing really, you know, and actually looking in a more kind of holistic way at their experience, rather than actually trying to exonerate the organizations, which in many cases are the true transgressors, in fact. So really bringing, I mean, within our, we add this kind of brick into the wall by bringing forward these lived experiences of whistleblowers, we try in that way to counteract the discourses that powerful organizations often use to actually, you know, construct whistleblowers as this abnormal kind of abnormal individuals who are actually unhealthy. Well, in as a very, very final conclusion, I think moving forward from that whistleblowing story, the important lesson for the future is that it is really in the organization's interest to actually prevent the whistleblowing. In what sense? By establishing, you know, the speaking up arrangements that these concerns are raised in the way that you have just described, Tom, internally, without them being escalated to the outside world, which, you know, creates all this kind of bad publicity and reputational damage. So it's in organizations' interest to actually try to create the culture of openness and transparency as much as possible. And in fact, for example, the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK has actually mandated by law every organization, a deposit holding organization, which holds a certain deposit, actually to have a whistleblowing champion. Okay, we can be cynical and say that it can be only a lip service, but actually this is in recognition of the service and in that whistleblowers actually do. And in fact, it's an attempt to try to actually change the organizational culture, because no law can actually change the organizational culture without the organizations adopting and actually, you know, addressing the issues in the ways that are relevant and appropriate to each organization. So I think that each of us has a role to play as researchers, citizen, and organizational member. And as a managers, we are actually maybe it's worthwhile us actually trying to do something about actually setting up channels for dealing with wrongdoing in organizations. That would be my final word. And I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you about the issues that we really think are very, very important and that we are actually, you know, kind of sold on a bit as researchers as well.
Mariana, you've been a wonderful guest. Thank you for being on the program. And we really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you very much.
And that's all for part 3 of episode 45. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time here on Talking About Organizations.